stay on lower side one. Will you receive? We're trying to pass through AM signal. How is that? You're starting from lower than the signal. You're going to the lower side band, through the carrier. You've got to have to hear the carrier, and then you're going to upper side band. Go ahead, and do it here.
Yes, without a doubt, a single sideband receiver can definitely listen to an AM broadcast signal, a signal that contains upper sideband, lower sideband, and carrier. And with the single sideband receiver set correctly, you'll get good reception of that AM signal into a sideband receiver. But there's a catch. Any error in the local oscillator you inject, in other words, if your receiver dial is set a little bit too high or a little bit too low, the local oscillator you're injecting will beat against the local oscillator that is in the original transmission, and you'll hear an extra tone, and that beat note will be very annoying, so it takes very careful tuning, more careful tuning of a sideband receiver's frequency, the main dial, when you're listening to an AM broadcast. Let me drop. So you got to be a little bit more accurate, a little bit more careful with that setting. You may have to use a fine-tuning function to get it just right. But when you get it just right, it'll sound beautiful. If your receiver had enough circuitry, you could literally phase lock your local oscillator on the carrier that's being transmitted. Therefore, you could not only make sure the frequency is right, but the phase is right. Turns out that as you inject your local oscillator again in receiver, because it's a sideband receiver, when it's an AM broadcast signal you're listening to, which has a carrier, you really like not only the carrier injection to be exactly the right frequency, there's a very desirable phase angle. So if it was a phase lock loop type of receiver, you could make that perfect. Going back now to a sideband signal you're listening to with a sideband receiver, let me drop. If, for instance, it was a lower sideband signal that you're listening to, and if you set the local oscillator, the main tuning dial, a little bit too high, everything you'll hear will be too high in pitch. That's one thing, and you can, a certain amount of pitch offset, you can tolerate up to 50 hertz, maybe 100 hertz of error, you can tolerate, and the human mind will still say, yeah, I know what the guy is saying. His voice is the wrong pitch, but I know what he's saying. But there's another catch. The way the single sideband local oscillator injection works, if you set it, say, 50 hertz too high, every single one of the notes of the human voice or the music you're listening to will all be offset 50 hertz higher in pitch. The problem with that is music, for instance, that would sound beautiful when everything is accurate, will now sound dissonant, because if all the music, if the violin was first playing a 1kc note and then playing a 2kc note, and I offset both by the same ratio, if I offset them by the same ratio, it'll sound good. But if I only add 50 hertz to the 1kc note out of the violin, and I add 50 hertz to the 2kc note, they don't have the same harmonic relationship anymore, and you'll call that dissonant. It'll sound very sour. So playing music through a single sideband receiver is a very severe requirement if you're a hi-fi listener, if you know what I mean, and you can see why. It violates the harmonic relationship of the individual notes if you have an error in that local oscillator that you re-inject. In 2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet. And by the way, some people's voice is a little bit more intelligible if you intentionally make their voice higher in pitch than reality. There are some guys who intentionally set all the voices they listen to a higher pitch because they think they get greater intelligibility with their particular hearing system and what they're used to listening to. You'd be amazed how many people will intentionally misset a single sideband receiver in order to get best copy during a pileup, if you know what I mean. And when the guy's grandmother walks into the room and says, what in the world are you listening to? That's not a human being. That doesn't sound right. Over to you, Wes. K2LAW.
You know, it was Radio Free Europe at the time of the communist horror. And I was using a single sideband receiver that I had made by myself. And that actually allowed me to cut off on the simple circuitry most of those Russian Soviet era transmitters, multi kilowatt power transmitters that were trying to restrict us with the words, to the voices of the free world. Thank you very much, Dick. It was an excellent answer. And to Xia.
Yeah, by using a single sideband receiver in that function when you're listening to Radio Free Europe, you had a huge advantage. When you're using an ordinary old-fashioned AM shortwave receiver to listen to Radio Free Europe, you get periodic fades of the signal where, because of selective rejection, in other words, because of the multipath and the multiple bounces of the ionosphere for the signal to get to you, every so often there is the equivalent of a notch filter walking through that signal. And when that notch filter of the multipath rejects the carrier, then all of a sudden the audio starts sounding like Donald Duck. And so some of the fading, when you listen to a shortwave receiver on Radio Free Europe, you can eliminate by listening with a sideband receiver, because you're now re-injecting the local oscillator. The selective fade no longer hits you, no longer affects you. Second of all, depending on the way the jamming and the RFI and EMI is taking place, you can decide at this instant of time you're going to listen to the upper sideband of Radio Free Europe. Later on, you can decide to listen to the lower sideband, and in all cases, you're re-injecting the local oscillator. Therefore, even if the local oscillator, if the carriers that they're transmitting get selectively faded, that doesn't give you that vulnerability. So during that Donald Duck section of a shortwave receiver, your sideband receiver will have rather good sounding audio. So you get a lot less vulnerability. Let me drop. You get a lot less vulnerability of missing carrier. And you can select whichever sideband has the best signal-to-noise ratio. So you've got a lot of capability using a sideband receiver when listening to an AM signal. I wonder if you ever had the chance of comparing your sideband receiver to your ordinary shortwave receiver that was an AM detector while listening to Radio Free Europe. If you happen to have those two receivers running side by side, you'd have a very interesting experiment. Wouldn't that have been a great one to try, Wes? N2XJN? H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yes, I did. I was even doing different things. I didn't have a gear phone. So, I was... before I had a single sideband receiver, I had a ability to receive... receive unmodulated signals, CW. I was using heterodyne from another radio receiver, regular radio receiver, to actually tune it at 100 kHz. So at that point, I was creating sort of remote BFO and mixing those signals together without coupling them physically, just make one radio next to the other with a piece of pipe. Allows me be able to then using the bandwidth of the circuitry of both of the receiver was suck out bad. I mean was simply bad. I was able to listen to the AM of the one single sideband of the AM Radio Free Europe this way. I believe you understand what I'm talking about. That's what it is.
Yes, I think I do. If your ordinary shortwave receiver, even though it's a little bit on the broad side, bandwidth-wise, if you tune the signal off to one side so that the IF skirt selectivity is starting to reject either the upper sideband or the lower sideband, and then by whatever means you re-inject the local oscillator locally, it could be with a peak frequency oscillator, it could be with another receiver where the local oscillator leaks. You've got the two antennas connected together, so the local oscillator in one receiver is coupling into the other, and some people will put their grid-to-dip oscillator or a signal generator into the antenna to inject the missing local oscillator. So now you can create a poor man's equivalent of a single sideband receiver with an ordinary AM receiver by doing off-tuning and carrier re-injection. It's a very crafty technique that some people have used. The right technique, of course, is a real sideband receiver, because a real sideband receiver, quite often it'll have something like a Collins crystal filter, you know, with the real steep skirts favoring just the upper sideband or the lower sideband, and now you get the much higher signal-to-noise ratio. So the best approach in the world is a real high-quality single sideband receiver. But you can force that function by off-tuning your short-wave receiver and injecting that missing carrier, or increasing the amount of carrier with an external oscillator of some kind, either coming from another receiver or a grid-tip oscillator or a signal generator. So I bet you've done quite a few of those experiments in order to get better reception of Radio Free Europe. Is that true, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
In other words, the only way for us to know how the world looks like. The world is appearing, the very next day it wasn't certain. So, yes, I became a ham radio operator because of my father trying to listen to Radio Free Europe when I was just 5, 6 years old. At 9 years old, I was my first transmitter. But anyhow, it was a difficult time. Thank you very much, Dick, and thank you for giving me so much time. I appreciate your answers. And to you.
Hey, Jack. Eric recognized that one of the things that you had as an advantage is the jamming signal of Radio Free Europe was not co-located with Radio Free Europe. Therefore, the way the signal skipped off the ionosphere and bounced off the ground had different number of bounces. So therefore, even if the jamming transmitter of Radio Free Europe was many watts higher in power, it doesn't stop you from receiving the signal from 100 or 1,000 miles away, because you're getting the two signals bouncing in a different way. For the sideband receiver, you'd have maximum capability there. KE2EJ, K2LIW, I wonder how much of these crazy receiving techniques you have used, Eric. You've got it, Eric.
Dick, I just wanted to point out a couple things. You know, a few years back, UPS managed to steal some of our 220 bands. And they used a method called ACSSD, where they essentially leaked a tiny little bit of carrier, which they had a phase lock loop within the receiver, and it was sideband. It took up only 3 kilohertz worth of space, and they could pack a lot of channels in it. Ma Bell or Western Electric, with all their microwaves for all those years, most people don't realize it, their phone calls were single sideband. And the third thing is, have you ever played with MATLAB, where you literally can draw a diagram of what a sideband receiver looks like, hits a button, and it spits out DSP code that does exactly that. I mean, today, more and more, filters, smilters, no more. We just have a front end and a D to A, rather than A to D, and math does the rest of it. K2LIW, K2J.
When I first met you, and I was over your house in either Brooklyn or Queens, I'm not quite sure where you were living at the time, you had just started getting pretty heavy into studying digital signal processing techniques, which is sort of what you're discussing right now. By way of digital signal processing, you can take a signal that's in the IF strip of a receiver, and the most ideal technique would be to do an analog-to-digital function of that signal with an I and Q, in phase and quadrature, two separate detectors going into two separate A to D's. And now you take that I and Q digitized signal and you properly process that with the right computer program. all kinds of magic. You can synthesize brick wall filters, with a notch. The notch is movable independently. Noise cancellation techniques, integration techniques, digital signal processing can really do some magic. Let me drop. But it has a little bit of a vulnerability, and that is, if this is the best of all worlds, your A to D function has a tremendous amount of excess dynamic range. If the signal suddenly becomes too strong, and your analog to digital function goes into what's called wraparound, which means the strongest possible signal, which should give you a very strong digital code because of wraparound, because you've exceeded the ceiling of its dynamic range, it suddenly gives you a very weak signal, apparent digital signal. Well, those wraparound functions will take your digital signal processing and drive it pretty crazy. And so you got to worry about instantaneous dynamic range of the way you set up the analog to digital function. You don't want to undervalue it or overvalue it, if you know what I mean. Undervalue means you'd have a poor signal-to-noise ratio. Overvalue it, you get wraparound. But as long as you've got enough dynamic range to your analog to digital functions, after that, boy, can you do all kinds of magic if you've got the right computer program. And I seem to remember when I met you in the late 60s or early 70s, you were just getting very heavy into that study of yours at that time, Eric. KE2EJ, I wonder if you remember that meeting where you actually walked me up to the roof of your house and showed me the antennas. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
K2IW, K2EJ, that was in Australia. Yeah, well, you know, you're talking maybe 15 years ago in terms of technology, you know, when I was playing with it. The registers were actually only 24 bits wide, but the result of a MAC, a multiply and accumulate, could be 56 bits. Now, with the FPGAs that we have, you know, companies like Altera and Xilinx, with the millions of gates inside the little packet, you can, in essence, make yourself 128 bit wide DSP. But, you know, there are some mathematical solutions to what you're talking about, and actually today's modern receivers, if they are, say, using a 30, like a Shark, a 32-bit DSP, they will include an ADC function that works both ways. It tells the software what the incoming signal strength is in the analog domain and instructs the process to take that into consideration. There's places where you can do windowing, there's places where you can do truncation, and you get around all those problems that we used to have in the very beginning as everybody was learning how to utilize it. You don't realize it today, but like these DMR radios, let me let it drop for a second. They are literally based around one chip, which is an OMAP chip, which is made by Texas Instruments. It's got a very, really good RISC processor in it, a traditional type of CPU that you find in your cell phone. And it also has a really extensive Sharp DSP built into the same chip. And the hardware construction of most of these radios is literally interchangeable from manufacturer to manufacturer because they all operate around this same basic design of hardware. And it's pretty darn flexible. But if you look at, like, the Flex radios, they don't use traditional computing. They build up their own FPGAs. They make their own DSPs. As they improve their software, they may actually add another DSP, which is generated in software, but actually becomes hardware because of the way the gates are put together. These types of very large array FPGAs without power are stupid, and they just look like a bunch of random gates, but when you turn it on and the HVDL gets loaded into it, it now looks like a piece of hardware. So, nice that you can literally change the hardware by just doing an upload.
K2IW, yeah, very fine, Eric. I think the combination of computers and RF hardware, not just a flash in the pan, I think it's going to catch on. That's a huge understatement. Right now, there's a very tight marriage between digital hardware and analog hardware. This fancy low noise noise, front end, frequency switching functions. I mean, who would have ever guessed that a handy talkie that used to be a couple of $1,000s from Motorola 20 or so years ago, that you could buy something of, 30% as good quality, but many thousand percent cheaper in price. I mean, $30 and $40 handy talkies that cover both the 2 meter band and the 450 band. Who would have ever guessed that that would be coming around? It's just a matter of time before people find ways of combining multiple of those inexpensive radios to do some fancy receiving functions. Let's see if Joe has come back. Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. I believe you signed in earlier, and maybe you just called away. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, if you're there. K-2-R-A-W in the tech net. You got it, Joe. I think it was you, John, that heard Joe. I'm not sure I heard Joe sign in, or maybe I did, and maybe I didn't. And if not, it's time we go over to the mailbag at this time. So what kind of challenging questions have you got this week, John? And there were some weeks in the past where John would get numbers like 75 separate emails with people asking questions. And of course, he's got to select just the best ones that have most universal appeal. Let's see what happened this week. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, well, it's a little slow with the holidays. Not much going on, but we have a few questions. And let me know the drop. I'll go on to the first one. Okay, I have a young amateur here who has heard about an antenna called a patch antenna. He hasn't got a clue of how it works or what it's used for. He'd like any information you have on it, Dick, and maybe you can describe its function and the benefits. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If you Google the word patch, you'll get a whole lot of information. If you've got any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, which are in four separate editions, and if you look at the section called Printed Circuit Antennas, or also in the later editions of the subject, a section called Patch Antenna, it's hard to believe that a patch antenna really is the printed circuit or microwave equivalent of a dipole. It's hard to believe. Ordinarily, you take your dipole might be on 80 meters, it might be made out of 14 gauge wire, it might be 132 feet long. And if there was a very huge, flat, metallic building nearby, and you slapped that dipole against the building, parallel to the building, with, say, 1 foot of spacing everywhere, at first you would say, that can't possibly work. It will work. That is a poor man's equivalent of a patch antenna. You may have to do a little bit of retuning, but that would be an antenna. And if you now start making the wire, instead of a 14-gauge piece of wire, you make it a flat piece of sheet metal, 67 feet long to the right, 67 feet long to the left, a flat piece of sheet metal, and the sheet metal is a foot wide. You're getting closer and closer to what a patch antenna is really like. And by the way, depending on how you're feeding it, you don't have to feed it in the center. It also could be one piece of sheet metal, a foot wide, and 132 feet long, sitting parallel to the metal side of the building, 1 foot away. That really is a patch antenna. Let me drop. But now let's be realistic. Nobody does that in HF. But when you start getting up to UHF frequencies, like say, for instance, 900 megacycles, where the wavelength is now something in the vicinity of 4.5 inches, and now a half wavelength of that is going to be 2 1/2 inches. If you take a piece of foil and put some kind of an insulator, you've got a large metallic ground plane, you've got a sheet of, let's say, fiberglass, and then you lay this foil on top. And if the foil is the right length or the right width, whether you make the width resonant or the length resonant or both, it's your choice. But now that metallic structure in parallel with your ground plane, separated by a piece of fiberglass, it looks like it should be a perfect short circuit. It looks like it couldn't possibly radiate. It radiates like a jaw. It may be a little bit narrowband. How narrowband it is a big function of what is the spacing of that fiberglass. As that fiberglass becomes thicker and thicker, your patch antenna develops more and more bandwidth, where it gives you a pretty good standing wave ratio. Let me drop. But now, let's look at the way the patch antenna radiates. It radiates by a slightly different process. Ordinarily, a dipole, like that 80-meter dipole, the majority of the current is in the center of the dipole. That current high in the center, if it's got a Q of 10, the current is 10 times higher than whatever current came out of your coaxial cable. That's what Q of 10 means. And the 10 times higher current in that 80-meter dipole has 10 times stronger magnetic fields in the center, and that's what does most of the radiating in my mind. And everyone's going to agree with that. That's my way of analyzing an antenna and the way it starts the radiation process, by a strong magnetic field oscillating at an RF frequency. In the case of a patch antenna, it's a different process. Because your patch is, and let's assume now that the length of the patch is a length that is half-wave resonant. And by the way, there's ways you can make a patch quarter-wave resonant. We won't go there right now. It's a half-wave resonant patch. One of the dimensions is electronically a half-wavelength long. And by way of the piece of sheet of fiberglass, it's laying flat up against a ground plane. Let me drop. And by way of your coupling structure, and there's a zillion different ways you can couple the signal into a patch antenna. We won't go into that right now. You've coupled some signal from your transmission line into that resonant piece of wide sheet metal that's laying on top of the fiberglass, that's laying on top of this large ground plane of metallic structure. And now you've launched the signal into that sheet metal of the patch. And at one instant of time, the right-hand side of the patch has got a strong positive voltage, the left-hand side has got a strong negative voltage. And now let's analyze the right-hand side. The right-hand side of the patch is positive. The ground plane that's a little bit further beyond that right-hand side of the patch is neutral. Relatively, it is negative, because the right-hand side of the patch at this instant of time is positive, and the ground plane alongside of it is merely as a revolt. Mother Nature looks at that and says, I see a great big positive to negative voltage across that right-hand edge. I see the high positive voltage of the patch. I see the much lower voltage of the ground plane. In my mind, that looks like a negative voltage. So you've got a kind of a dipole out at that edge. The left-hand side of that dipole, the right-hand side of the patch, has a positive voltage on the left side and a negative voltage on the right side across that right-hand edge. Now let's look at the left-hand edge at the exact same instant. The right-hand edge of the patch had positive voltage on it. The left-hand edge of the patch has negative voltage on it. And now let's look at that edge compared to the ground plane. The left-hand edge is negative. The ground plane is really neutral. Relatively speaking, there's a dipole out there. With, again, the ground plane, you think it's neutral. It's really more positive than the patch, and the patch is more negative.
Repeater, time out.
So now let's take a look at this. The left-hand side is a kind of a dipole with negative left, positive left, negative right on that left-hand edge of the patch. And I'm now comparing the voltage on the left-hand side of the patch versus the ground plane. There's a dipole out there with positive voltage, which is really the ground plane, versus negative voltage on the left side of the patch. The right-hand edge of the patch has positive voltage versus the ground plane. So those two dipoles on the two edges of the patch are in phase with each other. At this instant of time, both of those dipoles have positive left, negative right on the local dipole. So the dipole on the left-hand edge of the patch and the dipole on the right-hand edge of the patch are a pair of dipoles that are an interferometer. Because they're an interferometer, that patch radiates a signal that has a particular azimuth beamwidth, in the example that I'm giving. Let me drop. There's various ways that you can force the patch to resonate with a greater or lesser spacing between the left-hand edge and the right-hand edge. And that left-hand edge is a dipole, the right-hand edge is a dipole, and they're always in phase with each other in the example that I'm giving, and that far as interferometer, you can change the spacing between those two interferometers. You've got a certain amount of adjustment capability of the azimuth beam width of this patch antenna. At first, when you see a patch antenna and you realize that it's a resonating piece of metal separated by an insulator directly parallel to a great big ground plane, it looks like it should be a perfect short circuit and never resonate at all, and never radiate at all. Radiates like a charm. It's considerably more narrow in bandwidth compared to a in-free space antenna, but if you now want to make a conformal antenna, let me drop it. I've got this 5-foot diameter missile, a rocket, made out of sheet metal, and I'd love to have a conformal antenna that doesn't add any real diameter or width or height of the structure compared to the sheet metal of the rocket. And I now lay this, I lay a piece of fiberglass down in a particular place on the side of the rocket, lay a piece of sheet metal on top of it that is the patch antenna. It's only a 1/16 of an inch or 1/8 of an inch of greater thickness than the skin of the rocket, but that antenna can radiate like a charm. And I now got a transmitting antenna and a receiving antenna on the side of my rocket, which is conformal. It follows the shape and the diameter and the radius of the rocket. But it's, and now if I put a couple of them around the circumference of the rocket at a particular height above the between the nose and the tail, I can put a series of these around the perimeter of the rocket, and I can now I can radiate circular polarization. I can make a phased array of these things around the sides of that rocket that add almost nothing to the aerodynamic drag, and yet I can radiate or receive some beautiful signals with that antenna. Patch antennas, you can put them on, let me drop them. You can mount them on the leading edge of the wing of an airplane. You can mount them on the flat edge of the wing of the airplane. You can put them on the rudder leading edge, the side of the rudder, on the fuselage. And in all cases, properly designed, they have almost no aerodynamic drag. And you've got this beautiful antenna that looks like it should be a perfect short circuit. But as long as it's properly designed, it will radiate like a charm. You can easily make a patch antenna that has 95% radiation efficiency. You put 100 watts into it, and more than 95 watts gets radiated into space with an extremely predictable pattern as to where the signal goes. You can build a phased array of these things where you can electronically steer the signal you're radiating into space. Among we radio amateurs, let me drop. Except for the few guys that build patch-like antennas as a feed horn for the parabolic dish, except for those few microwave guys that have done that, we amateurs have very little exposure to patch antennas. It's a whole class of antennas. Of the 5,000 kinds of antennas that I believe exist, the patch antennas and the slot antennas are a whole universe of antennas that we get very little exposure to. There's very little information in our ham radio books on either one of those. It's an extremely valuable antenna. To learn about them and to dig into it is worth the price. It's worth the investment, because there are a number of circumstances where nothing else will work, nothing else will fit into that environment that'll meet the requirements for space, size, cost, aerodynamic drag, conformal, follow the curvature of the airframe, and so on. Patch antennas and slot antennas, very valuable antenna. The fact that we as amateurs haven't heard about them doesn't mean they're not extremely good and valuable and worth making the investment. There's a lot more to the story, but that's the beginning of the story, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet. I've done a fair amount of patch antenna work and some patents on those, by the way. Go ahead.
Yes, interesting question. We haven't had a question on patch antennas that I can remember. I do have one question about that now. We build a patch antenna, let's say it's 8 inches by 8 inches flat. We lay it on a table. What is the pattern of propagation? Is it directive? How much of it, if you could describe that pattern? Maybe you could try that to KC2WGB. Back to you.
Okay, I've got a large, flat, metallic table. I've got a sheet of fiberglass or foam of some particular thickness that I lay on top of the table. Then I lay my metallic patch antenna, which in your example is 8 inches wide, 8 inches wide and long, and I lay that on top of the phone. And now, by some means, I feed signal into that. We won't go into how I feed the signal into it. I can now force that antenna to radiate from left to right. In other words, the signal on there could be from left to right. Let me make your patch a little bit non-symmetric so I can make this easier. Let's assume that your patch is 8 inches left to right and 7 inches top to bottom. So it's a rectangular patch. So across the 8-inch dimension, I resonate at a particular frequency. I'm going to pick a frequency. Let's assume that I radiate at 500 megacycles left to right, 8-inch dimension. I'm rounding off the numbers. I've got an error, but it's an example. In the 7-inch dimension, I'm radiating it. It resonates at 600 megacycles. So left to right, 8 inches, it resonates 500 megacycles in my example. Top to bottom, 7 inches, it resonates at 600 megacycles. I can therefore force the patch to independently radiate a horizontally polarized signal at 500 megs and a vertically polarized signal at 600 megs. And I can do those two functions simultaneously, independently. They don't mix with each other if I've got the right feed point as to how I'm feeding this thing. And in my example of where you've got this flat on the table and the table's parallel to the ground, let me drop. The majority of that 500 meg signal will be horizontally polarized and radiate primarily straight up at zenith. And in this particular example, it would probably have a 70 or an 80 degree horizontal beamwidth at 500 megacycles. The 600 megacycle signal, again, will radiate straight up. It'll have almost exactly the same beamwidth, 80 or so degrees wide, vertically polarized, again radiating straight up, because those two dipoles that are on the edges of the patch are a pair of interferometry dipoles. There's a pair of 500 megacycle dipoles on the left-hand edge and the right-hand edge across the 8-inch dimension, and those two dipoles are in phase with each other as an interferometer, radiating at zenith, straight up, the majority of the signal. And the 600 megacycle dipoles on the upper edge and the lower edge, they're in phase with each other, an interferometer, radiating straight up. Let me drop. And if you plotted the full three-dimensional antenna pattern of this patch on the table that you and I are describing, you'd see a beautiful main lobe going straight up of both the 600 meg signal and the 500 meg signal. The signal would get weaker and weaker as I go down toward the horizon. The signal would have very little radiation at the horizon. Under normal circumstances, patch antennas do the majority of their radiating broadside. Normal to the patch is where they do the majority of the radiation. There is a way of setting up patch antennas, multiple ones of them, as a phased array where you can make an end fire, a Yagi-like structure where you force it to radiate out to the horizon in your example. That's a more elaborate version of patch. It's really a multiple patch antenna. But in general, patch antennas radiate in the normal direction. They radiate broadside, and I'm now giving you some of the explanation as to how they do that. We haven't gotten into how you feed them yet. There's a zillion ways how you can feed them. Let me drop a quick. One way to feed this is that you drill a small hole through your table, and you mount a connector on the bottom side of your table with the center conductor going through the table in an insulated manner, through the phone, and now soldered to the patch itself at a carefully chosen position on the patch. That's the way you usually feed the patch, with that very short, directly connected probe. If your foam was a half an inch thick, then the length of the center conductor coming out of your connector from the bottom of the table would be a half inch long, directly soldered to that patch, feeding signal into it. That's one of a zillion ways you can feed a patch. I wonder if you're starting to get the picture of how you feed these things, how you resonate these things, and how they radiate. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Okay, that's complete. Maybe you'll have a question on feeding it. He's very interested in this, evidently. all new to him. So maybe next week I'll get a question on how to beat it. All right. Now let me let it drop. I'll go on to my next one.
And by the way, that connector going through the table, through a hole in the connector, that's a hole in the table, through the phone into the patch. There's a zillion different places where you can select that connector. As you move that connector closer and closer to the center of the patch, the impedance of that connector, the apparent impedance of the antenna, becomes a lower and lower number. You could choose a position where the patch appears to be a 5-ohm antenna. You move that connector closer and closer to the outer edge of the patch, you can think that the antenna is a 500-ohm antenna, and maybe even higher than that. So, depending on where you select that connector that feeds the patch, you can decide what impedance you like. And there's a magic position where you feed the patch, and it is a 50-ohm antenna. Now, that's if the patch is along the center line, left to right. If I now chose to mount that connector a little bit off of the center line, I've now moved it a little bit vertically above or below the center of the antenna, I'm now starting to feed some signal into the other polarization of the patch. By choosing the correct position of the feed point, by choosing the correct dimensions, horizontal dimension and vertical dimension of the patch, I can make the one connector launch a simultaneous amount of horizontal signal and vertical signal, because the horizontal dimension, let me drop, because the horizontal dimension and the vertical dimension are a little bit different in my next example. One is going to be slightly above resonance, one's going to be slightly below resonance, one's going to be a little bit capacitive, one's going to be a little bit inductive, but you're looking at both of them in parallel, they cancel, it's now a 50-ohm antenna, but you're launching some horizontal signal with delayed phase, you're launching some vertical signal with advanced phase, because one's capacitive and one's inductive. You've now, with that one connector, you've launched simultaneous horizontal and vertical signal, both on the exact same frequency in this second example, because of the phase shift between the two, it's now launching a beautiful signal straight up that is circular polarized. Carefully chosen, carefully dimensioned patch antennas with the feed point in the right position will give you a beautiful circular polarization. Inexpensive as all hell, high performance, high efficiency, circular polarization, a little bit narrow band in frequency, but the pattern you can predict, very low aerodynamic drag, circular polarization, broadside antenna, and you can put one on the, you're looking at the missile top view, you can put one at the 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock, one at the 9 o'clock, one at the 3 o'clock, it can radiate some beautiful signals out to the horizon, circular polarized with that antenna. An antenna a little bit like that, at one time, was mounted on the top of the Empire State Building for FM broadcast, circular polarization. Over to you, John, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Wow, very useful antenna, and I'm surprised we haven't heard more about that. It's not in amateur fields right now, but would be something interesting to play with. Well, wish him luck with that. Okay, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my next one. KC2WGB. I have a question here from a gentleman who has listened to a couple of broadcasts on the TechNet. He hears you discussing low. I'd like you to describe that.
John, it's got many facets to it. If I use extremely exact wording, does an 80-meter dipole have slow wave characteristic? The answer is yes. Know that when you calculate the length of a dipole, calculate its length to be 95% of the free space wavelength. In other words, you could assume that the signal traveling down your 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge wire and it's 132 feet long, you could assume the signal travels down the wire, not at the free space velocity, It has a velocity factor of roughly 0.95. The signal travels down the wire 95% of the speed of light to a very slight amount that is a slow wave structure. In reality, what's really going on is you've got some end-loading capacitance. You've got a great big loop at the end where you've got your egg insulator. That is a top hat capacitor at the end that brings it a little bit lower in frequency. So is the wire really slow wave? When you get down to the microscopic level, maybe not, but it acts like it is. Let me drop. But now let's talk about a real slow wave structure. A piece of RG8U coax cable with polyethylene jive dielectric has a velocity factor of 66%. In other words, a wavelength inside of the coax cable is 66% of the length it would be in free space. You take the dielectric material, in this case polyethylene, which I think has got a dielectric constant somewhere around 3.5, but you take the square root of that dielectric constant, divide it into 1, that is the velocity factor. So what is the real dielectric constant of polyethylene? Because I know it's got 66% velocity factor, and I know that's 1 over the square root, I can reverse the whole process. I can take the 66% and square it, and then take 1 over it. I now know the dielectric constant of that particular dielectric material that's in that coax cable. So you can do the same thing with Teflon cable, which runs more like, I think, 85% velocity factor. So coax cable with anything except air as a dielectric is a kind of a slow wave structure. Numbers like 66 and 88% velocity factor. Let me drop. I can now take a chunk of foam, and I now have chunks of foam of various dielectric constants, and I lay them together as a sandwich. I can now shape that three-dimensional foam object, and I can make a Yagi-like antenna. I've got a feed horn at one end, feeding these various chunks of foam that have various thicknesses and various dielectric constants, because some of the foams are high in density, some of them are low in density. I can make a Yagi-like antenna out of that structure. It's called a dial guide antenna. So that's a slow wave structure. There's a more elaborate three-dimensional version of that, which is called the Lundberg lens antenna. It looks like a spherical object around your feed horn, which is really acting as a lens, and it gives you a pencil-like beam coming out of that antenna, and it also can be scanned in frequency, but we won't go there right now. So a Yagi structure is one of the most classic slow wave structures. Let me drop. If I make a Yagi with, say, 10 elements, it's got a reflector-driven element and 8 directors. Each of those directors are a dipole-like structure along that boom, along the length of the boom, and they're all at right angles to the boom, and every one of those directors is less than a resonant length. They're shorter. They're tuned to a higher frequency, so to speak. At the frequency where I'm operating the Yagi, each one of those is a capacitive load. Whenever you take a dipole-like structure and you make it too short, the impedance is a capacitor. Make it too long, the impedance is an inductor. So each one of those directors is a three-dimensional capacitor hanging in space. That signal comes along from infinity out there on the horizon, and the signal hits your Yagi, and it starts hitting each one of those directors, which are a kind of capacitor in space. It is a synthesized slow wave structure. I could take that signal that's going along the boom and slow it down by putting pieces of polyethylene in the right spot, great big chunks of polyethylene. I could make a dipole, I could make a Yagi-like structure out of great big chunks of polyethylene. It would be extremely heavy, extremely expensive, but I could make a Yagi out of that. Let me drop it. I could slow down that signal going down that boom with great big chunks of polyethylene. For instance, adjust the right shape. Maybe they're going to be in circles and they're stacked along that boom as if the boom is a screw going through the center of these circles, if you know what I mean. So the directors are a poor man's equivalent of that. It's a synthesized structure. The nice thing about the chunks of polyethylene, it would be very broadband, because the polyethylene has almost constant dielectric constant as I sweep in frequency. The directors of my Yagi are very narrowband. Only at certain frequencies do they have the right amount of capacitance to give me the right slow wave function that gives me the focus. now I'm saying that those eight directors in my example, it really is a poor man's equivalent of a magnifying glass. It's a beautiful focusing structure. Let's go back to that magnifying glass. Let me drop. Each of us takes a physics course in which we're told that the refractive index of the glass, of this double convex magnifying glass, that's where the function, that's where the focusing comes from. You have these individual rays coming in, some of them near the center, some of them halfway between the center and the perimeter, some of them near the perimeter, and they hit the glass at a particular angle because it's a double convex piece of glass. And once you know the refractive index, you know how much the signal goes into the glass and is steered closer to the normal of that surface of the glass. And you know the way the wave gets bent going into the magnifying glass, and therefore it gets focused. Let me drop. That's the way optics is taught in our schools. It's one way of teaching it. It's the way that is 40% accurate. The way that's 60% accurate is to consider the glass a slow wave structure. We know the glass has a certain dielectric constant. The dielectric constant and the refractive index, there's a mathematical relationship between the two. But the signal, the optical signal flowing into the glass moves more slowly than it does through free space. That's what gives it that bending function when the signal enters the glass, as it enters that first surface of the glass, and it gets bent by the so-called refractive index phenomenon. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that the signal coming from space, let's assume it's sunlight. Let me drop. Let's assume that the sunlight is radiating one single frequency. It's a beautiful sine wave generator in my example. And I'm now looking at that sheet of sunlight coming toward me. Each individual phase front of the sunlight at each individual cycle is a completely parallel sheet of energy coming into your magnifying glass. And the sheet of energy is at right angles to the axis of the magnifying glass. You can see how that sheet of energy, as it hits the magnifying glass, because the magnifying glass is double convex, it's going to hit the center of the glass first. In the beginning of the sheet of metal, just sheet of energy, just hitting the magnifying glass, near the center, it's going to hit first. And as the wave starts propagating into the magnifying glass, at a later time, the portion of that sheet of energy hits the perimeter of the magnifying glass. But wherever the energy hits the magnifying glass, as it penetrates the glass, that portion of the wave gets slowed down. Let me drop. So you can draw yourself a series of pictures in the time domain as the first cycle of that sheet of energy, the phase front, comes into the magnifying glass, and the center of the magnifying glass gets hit first, the perimeter gets hit later as that sheet of energy penetrates the glass. Because the portion in the center is going through a thicker chunk of glass, it is delayed more. The glass is a slow wave structure. It's a delay structure. The light travels through the glass more slowly than it does through free space. By the time your sheet of energy has propagated all the way through the glass, the portion in the center is delayed the most, because that's where the glass was the thickest. The portion out at the perimeter is delayed the least. That's where the glass is the thinnest. Let me drop. So that exact same phase front of that flat sheet of energy that penetrated your magnifying glass, by the time it exits your magnifying glass, it is now a concave surface. It started off as a flat surface before it hit the magnifying glass. After it propagates through your magnifying glass, it's a concave surface. Okay. Snell's law is it? Huygens' principle tells you that each little microscopic section of your phase front, the wave locally propagates at right angles to the phase front. So all of the signal of that concave surface of the phase front that has just gone through that magnifying glass is a concave wave front when viewed from the back end, so to speak. And it's all propagating at right angles to that curved phase front, the concave phase front. It's parabolic in shape, so to speak. You can see how now all the individual rays are all pointed toward the focal point. So it's a slow wave function of the magnifying glass that focuses that wave down to a point. It's the and that's what gives you the focus function. To look at the magnifying glass as a slow wave structure, as a dielectric slow wave structure, and it's differentially slowing down the signal more in the center than the perimeter. Let me drop. That focusing function I just described, in my opinion, is the 60% accurate way of describing what a magnifying glass does, and the way that it's taught in our schools is the 40% accurate way, where we talk about refractive index and the bending of the individual light waves. They both take place. They both take place to the exact same amount. But one explanation, in my mind, gives you a better picture. Once you look at the magnifying glass as a slow wave structure that does focusing. Now let's go back to that Yagi. The signal flowing down the center of the Yagi near the boom is going through the center of every one of those directors. Every one of those directors is a capacitor in free space slowing down the signal. The signal that's a little bit further away from the boom is nearer the perimeter of those directors. It's further away from the director, it gets less of the effect. So that parallel phase front of the signal coming into your Yagi, the portion of it near the Yagi boom gets slowed down more than the portion of the signal that's further away from the Yagi boom. That's the way the directors behave. Doesn't look it, but once you understand what's going on, that is a magnifying glass. It is taking that sheet of energy coming into the front end of the Yagi. Let me drop it. There was a completely flat phase front coming in, and as it propagates down the Yagi, it becomes a parabolic shaped, it becomes a concave shaped phase front. That's focusing that signal from, in a case of a 2 meter Yagi, it's taking a 10-foot diameter of space and focusing that signal down to the driven element. That's the focal point, and all of those directors out in front is a magnifying glass. It doesn't look it. It is a magnifying glass. Once you look at the real magnifying glass in the 60% accurate method of analysis, from my point of view, you see how it creates a concave phase front. The slow wave structure of those directors on the Yagi creates a concave phase front. Focuses that signal down to the driven element. What little bit of the signal that gets beyond the driven element hits the reflector, gets reflected back. If you take a high-performance Yagi, in my example, a 10-element Yagi, and it's now operating beautifully, and you yank the reflector off of it, you get a slight change in the impedance of the driven element, and you readjust the impedance of the driven element so it's back to normal. You're about to say, how much energy did you lose? I've actually done that experiment. You lose a couple of tenths of a dB. The reflector does something for you. It does a minor amount of effect compared to that slow wave structure of those directors out in front. 95% of the energy of the real focusing effect of a Yagi is due to the directors. They're the ones that are working real hard and doing all the work. Let me drop. The reflector, by comparison, is only doing 5% of the work. Yeah, go ahead and put the reflector there. You're getting something from it. And it does improve your front-to-back ratio. But when it comes to the real forward gain, it's a minor effect. If you have the choice of building a small number of elements of a Yagi, and you're gonna use all your metal up making directors or making reflectors, choose directors. You get more bang for your dollar out of directors. Directors are a beautiful magnifying glass slow wave structure. And by the way, there's something called the Koch antenna. Mr. Koch invented an antenna in which he took a sheet of foam, which is a very low density foam, which is essentially transparent at radio frequencies. Let me drop. And he took metallic washers and he buried them in the foam. And he changed the density of the washers. He had a whole lot of washers in the center of this great big circle of foam, and very few washers near the perimeter of this foam, and a taper of the density of the washers in between. He made a radio equivalent of a magnifying glass. It's called the Koch antenna. Does a beautiful job of focusing. So there's various ways you can synthesize a slow wave structure that has a velocity profile. In the case of a magnifying glass, the velocity profile is such that you get a lot of slowing down of a signal near the center of the magnifying glass, and you get very little